Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 182, Force for Good, Buddha Verses and Bodhisattvas.
When it was published in the 70s, I guess, I gave a copy to my teacher, a Mongolian Lama, Geshe Wangyal, who was semi-retired by then, and he was in his 70s. And I said, here, Geshe Lama, I know you don't read this kind of English translations. You know, you have the Tibetan, but maybe you can put it in the library of the monastery where he was. And he said, oh, you're beginning to study that. And I said, no, I translated it. And yes, he said, you're beginning to study it. And then I stubbornly repeated, I said, no, but I translated it. And he said, yes, you're beginning to study it. Then I gave up, I quit. And of course, he was absolutely right. You know, over the years, I must have read it 50, 60, 80 times with students, and both in academia and in settings like this, sort of. And there's just so much more in it, you know. And it's so short, actually. It's quite marvelous. And it's like an anthology of all the Mahayana sutras. It has like elements from all of the huge, and Mahayana sutras are enormous literature, really quite big. Maybe like 100 Bibles or something. You know, if you printed them all in small print, there's a big, huge pile of them in the kind of long, big Tibetan book with the big Tibetan letters. You know. Silographic printed book. So Vimalakirti lives in a house where thousands of people go inside. And then he can encompass any number of people, and yet it's like an ordinary sized house in a town. And this is thousands of years old. And they didn't call it sci-fi in those days. It's a spiritual scripture. And so this is because of infinite relativity, anything is possible, in other words. So the first chapter is called The Purification of the Buddha Field, as I translated it in those days. And actually still, there's a version online. You don't have to buy this book. There's a slightly updated version on the website of a group called 84,000 online in their reading room. It's a free, you know, common copyright or whatever, you know, it's free. My translation is there. And the Word of the Buddha, the 84,000 website, you can find that online. And so you can read it. And the first chapter is called Purification of the Buddha Field, because that's a conventional word. But I call it a Buddha verse. You know, a Buddha verse is how the world seems to be for a Buddha. Like for us, it's a universe. Because each of us, in our unenlightenment, and please forgive me if you happen to be enlightened. I know you don't mind. But if we're unenlightened, we're in a universe, because it all turns. Verso means to turn, so it turns around us, because each of us secretly is the one of the uni. So it's our universe, right? So a Buddhaverse is different. Buddhaverse means it all turns toward enlightenment. And the difference of our cognition, self-enclosed, self-centered cognition, I'm not, that doesn't mean we're necessarily too selfish or thing, but we, our wiring is such that we're self-centered. We think we are inside our skin and we are the, in the center of our consciousness or somewhere, or maybe in our brain, we think, or something. And but a Buddha doesn't think that. An enlightened being feels they are equally everybody else as themselves. If you can imagine that. You can imagine it if you've ever had a child or been in love. You are identified very strongly with someone else, where you sort of feel you are them, at least for a moment, you know, for a while, you know. Moms do that for a while. And lovers do that also for a while, all too short, usually, right? But a Buddha is a being that feels that way about everybody, and then once they really feel that, they're forever, kind of, you know. They are everywhere. They're with everyone. They feel they are everyone. They feel that others' suffering is intolerable. So they manifest whatever they can, and they seem to have very powerful ability to do that manifestation. And they are presented as that anyway. So I hope so. I'm still hoping so. I think so. Okay, so all Buddhist sutras begin with, in those days I wrote, "Thus have I heard at one time." Although I don't like that nowadays, but that's still, I think I didn't change that because they didn't let me. Editors of the 84,000. Eventually I will change it. "Thus did I hear on a special occasion," is what I would like to say, on a certain occasion. "Thus did I hear," or rather than "have I heard." You know, "have I heard" is like how you hear a rumor, you know, "I heard around town, have I heard." But what this phrase means, evam maya shrutam ekasmin samaye, which is the beginning of all valid Buddhist sutras, which purport to be recordings of Buddha's own activities and statements and deeds and so on. And what that means is that the person who recited this and who others then learned it from or wrote it down, etc., the rapporteur, you could say, did hear this directly from the Buddha on a special occasion. That's what it means. So it's a sort of, it's a statement of the authenticity, you know. So, "have I heard" has a little bit rumorish sort of thing about, you know, "I heard around," you know. And then they put the "at one time" back, "at one time the Buddha was somewhere." But that's wrong. It's "thus did I hear on a certain occasion, on a single occasion I heard it." That's what somebody's saying, you know. Anyway, the old Buddhist sutras are like that. "The Lord Buddha was in residence in the garden of Amrapali, in the city of Vaishali, attended by a great gathering." So then they describe the assembly of a lot of monks. There are 8,000 monks in his entourage, according to that, and 32,000 bodhisattvas. The bodhisattvas are, some of them come from other universes in Mahayana sutras, because when a Buddha teaches in a particular planet, then they come zooming in, and they had aliens. They were happy with aliens. They were nice aliens. Because they were bodhisattvas, and they didn't have to have ships and metal ships, you know, and drive around. They just could go by mind travel, just a zip like that. They could beam into this solar system or whatever it was. And so some of them are parked in the sky, you know. Then there are all kinds of gods and fairies and elves, and quite a collection of entities. And they're described here in detail, which are, you know, about the monks, he said. They were calm and dignified like royal elephants. These are really enlightened mendicants. They had accomplished their work. They were all saints, all of them. They had done what they had to do, cast off their burdens, attained their goals, and totally destroyed the bonds of existence. So in a way, they had attained a kind of nirvana, these mendicants, Buddha's disciples. They all had attained the utmost perfection of every form of mind control. They were great yogis and yoginis. There were some nuns also, some female mendicants. And then the bodhisattvas, they go on more at length about the bodhisattvas, you know, which sattva means something like a hero, and bodhi means, or heroine or hero, it's not gender neutral, and bodhi means enlightenment, so enlightenment hero. And they are highly advanced and developed beings, many of them. Some are real beginners, actually. Anybody who gets an idea that they could become a perfectly enlightened being, and that that's the best thing to do with your life, is try to become that with your living process, and makes a vow that I'm going to become a being who's going to be total bubble of bliss forever, and I'm going to be so helpful to all the other beings, I'm going to see to it that they become free of suffering. I'm going to bring them all with me. That person becomes a bodhisattva when they really become dedicated like that. They become that, even though they don't have anything like the ability to do it. But in a way, they're two prerequisites. They have to recognize there is such a higher type of consciousness that is achievable, or embodiment and consciousness, as a Buddha, which is not easy to imagine. It's not a god. It's not an ordinary human. It's something really remarkable, different kind of a being, almost. But it comes out of the human form most easily. Also a divine form, but human form most easily. And that's the first thing. One has to be able to imagine that, to have that as a goal, that it's possible. And then second is, one has to have a sense of the conservation of energy, like the second law of thermodynamics, and including one's mind process as an energy, and realize that one will never not be continuing, so that it doesn't seem preposterous to say, I'm going to change the entire universe and bring all beings into happiness. Because you might as well, since you're stuck with them for eternity anyway. And when you feel that's the common sense thing, then it becomes like normal. It doesn't become like a crazy thing, you know. So I have a slogan I like to do when I talk about the Book of the Dead. A lot of you have heard it, I'm sure, too many times. Nobody gets out of here a dead. So that's the second prerequisite. So that there is this possibility of this higher form of existence, of being an enlightened being, and that you have endless time to achieve it, where you and all beings will be in a state of permanent bliss without any suffering. That's possible, and is therefore highly desirable. There couldn't be anything more desirable, don't you think? We can't imagine it, and so therefore we have to work to imagine it. That takes effort. But it becomes imaginable in the context of infinite relativity, and infinite and eternal also. So infinite in time as well as space. Given infinite time, anything could happen. And given infinite relational reality, anything can happen. Right? Yeah? Some of you look skeptical. Well, because people are scared of infinity, of course. Because then everything could be out of control, you know. They don't know, something might pop up out of infinity. You know, if our whole universe that we see, you know, could be itself inside a subatomic particle inside a different dimensional universe, then some bulldozer could run over it 1 second from now. It would be much worse than Santa Barbara or an earthquake or like a hurricane. You know. The whole thing could instantly be destroyed, right? Like, you know, or we could be a subatomic particle in somebody in another giant universe's electron accelerator, and they're looking for the Higgs boson. they just blow us up. We'll send all the bozos in the White House and here and there. You know. So, about the bodhisattvas, they were expert in knowing the spiritual faculties of all living beings. They were brave with the confidence that overawes all assemblies. They had gathered the great stores of merit and of wisdom, and their bodies were beautiful without ornaments, or beautiful without ornaments, were adorned with all the auspicious signs and marks. They were exalted in fame and glory like the lofty summit of Mount Sumeru. That's the planetary axis in the old world model. Their high resolve, that's their messianic resolve to be Buddhas, you know, to save all beings from suffering, as hard as diamond, unbreakable in their faith in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Dharma means the reality and the teaching of reality. Sangha means the community. Buddha is the teacher. They showered forth the rain of ambrosia that is released by the light rays of the jewel of the Dharma, which shines everywhere. And then he goes on, and then they are inexhaustible mines of limitless virtues, and they glorified innumerable Buddha fields with the splendor of these virtues. Were one to extol them for innumerable hundreds of thousands of myriads of aeons, one still could not exhaust their mighty flood of virtues. The bodhisattvas, they're these amazing, wonderful beings. Yes? Well, modern materialists would think that such beings were mythical, of course. But Buddhists don't think so. Again, because, you see, you know, maybe they're simple-minded Buddhists, but on the other hand, in the context of infinite relativity, if an infinite internal relativity, anything is possible. So since one can't disprove that there are all these kind of extraordinary beings, then, okay, these people say they are there. We're kind of doubtful. We don't think we've seen anybody like that lately that we've noticed, unless we have seen some extraordinary person, which maybe some of us have. So, you know, it's a stretch. That's why I say the goal is to imagine. And that's why we begin with Heart Sutra, where what the meaning of emptiness is negation, where we shatter our normal convictions about that's a solid pillar and this just this way and I'm just that way and that's just what it is. Because, you know, actually we just don't really know that. You know? I mean, even, you know, if you don't go even to that extent, you know the old story I always tell about the quantum physicist who had snowshoes in his lab. Have you heard me tell that one? Some of my, you heard me do that one. He has snowshoes on the wall of his lab, puts them on, because when he goes in the lab, he thinks of himself as a bunch of empty space with a bunch of atoms and electrons and nuclei in it. And he doesn't want to fall through into the subway or into the core of the Earth, you know, by gravity, because he's just a bunch of electrons and mostly empty space. So we know that's a model of what we are. We're made of atoms and things, right? We think. And yet we also think, this is me, solid flesh and blood and bone. But actually, we know that the scientists would say we're not. We'd look at us in an X-ray machine. We're just, you know, a CAT scan. It doesn't even seem strange to us. But we don't expect that we can perceive that ourselves. But actually, we are. Therefore, what we are seeing, thinking, is the objective reality of a flesh and blood, what John Perry Barlow calls a meat space human. We're here in meat space, but we think that's just it. That's objectively real. So we have a big conviction, this is me. But actually, we even know from science that that's illusory. It doesn't not exist, we're here, but we're not what we think we are. So we know that. And these people take it just a lot further. They did, you know, from old time. So then, anyway, now what happens is this very strange thing. I remember when I was translating this, I couldn't even believe myself on like the third page. You know, there's the Buddha, he's sitting there, and then the gods are all there, and the guy Brahma, the god Brahma Shikin, he's like what the people of Buddha's era thought was the creator god. You know, Jehovah, Yahweh, that's Yahweh, from Indian Yahweh at that time, monotheistic creator god. But here he shows up, and the creator gods of other universes can't come too, whole crowds of them. Because they always like to go when Buddha's going to, or something amazing is going to happen, they always go. What do you know? You know, they said Zeus is there. Chakra means a kind of Zeus type of figure, and a lot of other ones. Anyway, there he's sitting. Okay? Then these young kids from the city come out because their parents are not coming. And they're bringing these Indian kind of jeweled parasols. You know, they're very wealthy. The reason Buddhism happened in India 2,500 years ago is it was the richest part of Eurasia by far. More than Egypt, more than Mesopotamia, more than China. India was the absolute richest. And, you know, Maharajas weight in jewels type of thing, you know, rich. So they bring out these jeweled parasols. Then they put the jeweled parasols on it. So they come. The Lichavi Bodhisattva, Lichavi is the name of the nation in which the city of Vaishali was. Bodhisattva Ratnakara, Ratnakara means jewel mine, his name, with 500 Lichavi youths, each holding a precious parasol made of 7 different kinds of jewels, came forth from the city of Vaishali and presented himself at the grove of Amarpali. Each approached the Buddha, bowed at his feet, circumambulated him clockwise 7 times, laid down his precious parasol in offering, and withdrew to one side. That's just a formality that they do when they meet some kind of holy man in India. But then this one, as soon as these precious parasols had been laid down, suddenly by the miraculous power of the Buddha, they were transformed into a single precious canopy, so great that it formed a covering for this entire billion world galaxy. The surface, you know, even the word galaxy and billion worlds is there, but galaxy is just kind of a, you know, to fit it in our cosmology, it's just somehow hopeful. But it's a different cosmology, but still billion different worlds, really. And he made a parasol out of the pile of jeweled parasols. And I was trying to figure out, what is that, a canopy? And I realized it's like a planetarium. He created a temporary planetarium as a special effect, the Buddha did, out of those parasols to teach people something. And he said, it formed a covering. The surface of the entire billion world galaxy was reflected in the interior of the great precious canopy, where the total content of this galaxy could be seen. Limitless mansions of suns, moons, and stellar bodies. The realms of the gods, dragons, goblins, fairies, etc., titans, all these other mythological animals from our modern point of view, and the realm of different gods and things, mountains, all the great oceans, rivers, bays, torrents, streams, brooks, and springs, all the villages, suburbs, cities, capitals, provinces, and wildernesses. All this could be clearly seen by everyone. And the voices of all the Buddhas of the 10 directions could be heard proclaiming their teachings of the Dharma in all the worlds, the sounds reverberating in the space beneath the great precious canopy. So he just created a vision of everyone of total interconnection, of total sort of presence in the of nature, but in a completely inconceivable way, actually. It's, again, unimaginable. Imagination stretching vision, like you might have in a planetarium, you know, there's stars and different galaxies, and then they can go different things. Then you're out in the Hubble telescope pictures they can show you, or they can show you different environments on Earth, you know. If you go up to the Rose Planetarium, you know, used to be the Hayden Planetarium, now it's the Rose Planetarium, right? So he showed that to people, first thing, yes?
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallahs. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this week's episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. This two-part podcast was originally recorded at the Tibet House US Force for Good class series in February 2018. The Force for Good class series is an ongoing effort by Robert Thurman and Tibet House US to introduce the world to the Dalai Lama's secular teachings. As we heard in the first half of the podcast, Bob brought us through a live translation of the holy teachings of Vilmakirti. Using his own classic translation of the text available through Pennsylvania State University Press, as a starting point for the teaching, Professor Thurman in this podcast and in all his Force for Good teachings demonstrates his most endearing and most exciting method of teaching. That of the real-time live translation. If you've ever seen Bob in person or attended one of his intensive retreats at Menla, you'll know what I'm talking about. Bob will take a translation of a text that he's worked with for years, and in real time with the retreat participants and the students in the room, he updates it and informs it with the things he's learned since the last time he's translated it. To download a free copy of the text Bob is translating online, check the podcast description. Now, the second half of this week's episode includes a short introduction to the chanting of the Heart Sutra and a more in-depth exploration of the concepts of Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and Buddha verses. And be sure to stick around after the second half of this week's episode. Gary Gock returns for a lovely poetry reading that I think you'll enjoy. If you've enjoyed the poetry sections we've added to the podcast the past couple episodes, please be sure to visit the podcast description to learn more about Gary Gock and his new book now available through Sounds True. Pause, Breathe, Smile is a great book on the intersection of mindfulness and poetry. from the few books I've encountered recently that doesn't cater to one audience or another too strongly. It's a great general book for anyone interested in Buddhism, creative process, and mindfulness. Gary generously donates his time and efforts to producing the podcast poetry section, so help us out by lending him some support by checking out his book online. It's available through Sounds True and also Amazon.com. And as always, the Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part through the generous support of the Tibet House US membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including special Dasit tours with Robert Thurman and friends with geographic expeditions, please visit tibethouse.us. Interstitial music for the Bob Thurman Podcast is provided by Tenzin Chogyal. To learn more about Tenzin Chogyal, visit his website at tenzinchogyal.com. And now, back to Bob and Gary.
So now we begin with the Vimalakirti. I usually, beginning of a class here, we usually chant together the Heart Sutra. Think about the Heart Sutra, the key thing about it, so we'll think about it. And the key thing about the Heart Sutra is the emptiness is form, form is emptiness, form is not other than emptiness, emptiness is not other than form. That's the key thing. And form means matter. You know, it doesn't just mean a shape. Anyway, I don't like the translation of form. I always like to say emptiness is matter, or voidness is matter. Matter is voidness. Because the key thing about emptiness is it's just the relativity of all the things. It isn't some space in which they are. Space can be an analogy for emptiness, but emptiness is not space. Emptiness is, space is also empty, you know. And so emptiness means that no thing has intrinsic reality. Everything is empty of an fixed intrinsic reality, which means everything is relative. And so the absolute is all of the relativity. So emptiness really is the Buddha's discovery of relativity. That's what it is. Long before dear Mr. Einstein. So let's reflect on that for a minute before we begin. And then you can chant with me. Let's all chant a little bit. Om gate gate paragate.
Om gate gate paragate.
Parasamgate bodhi swaha.
Om gate gate paragate.
Parasamgate bodhi swaha. Om gate gate paragate parasamgate bodhi swaha.
Om gate gate paragate parasamgate bodhi swaha.
Now all together, with me, not wait. Om gate gate paragate parasamgate bodhi swaha. Om gate gate paragate. Samgate bodhi swaha, gate gate para gate para samgate bodhi swaha. That's great. That means, as you know, I think, does everybody know what that means? That's the mantra of Prajnaparamita, which means transcendent wisdom. And it is the mantra of, and she is a goddess actually. She's the great mother of all Buddhas. They call her Sarvajina Mata, mother of all victors. And but she also is reality. She's the reality of emptiness slash relativity. And the gate means gone. It's the past passive participle of the verb to go. So gate means gone. So it's like saying gone, gone, very, super gone. Paragate is super gone. Super totally gone, enlightenment, all hail. That's what it literally means, that mantra. But it's a mantra, so it just evokes the sense of emptiness. And the emptiness doesn't mean nothingness. So if you have an experience where you feel you disappear, it actually is a very important and powerful experience to sort of let go of yourself completely. But then the seeming sort of encounter, losing consciousness, let's say, or being as if everything is nothing or something, of course, is not an encounter with nothing, because you can't encounter nothing because it isn't there. So when you have an experience of seeming unconsciousness, it's something you're projecting also. Just like when you have an experience of the wall, you have an idea of a wall, and your brain has a concept for a wall, and it organizes the subatomic and atomic reactions in your optic nerve and your brain and everything into a perception of a wall. So in a way, you're sort of co-creating the wall in your perception. You know, you think you see the wall in itself, evidently the wall, and it sort of comes over to say, I'm a wall. But actually, we're creating that as a wall. And if you're very drunk or something, you wouldn't know what it was, you know. And when your brain is not doing that organizing, you know. And so similarly, when you have an experience of nothing, it's because you have an idea of nothing. And you have an idea of being unconscious. And so you think that's absolute, that's the problem of materialists. They think that that sort of going unconscious is like going to be what death is, and that's what they're going to happen to them when they die. And they're going to rest in nothingness. But that's a total delusion, because nothing means there is no nothing. Nothing is not there, so it's not a dark space. And that's not emptiness either. It's just our last sort of ditch, you know, projection, actually. The feeling of disappearing into nothing. That's kind of a projection. But that's a little hard to, I mean, you can get it logically, maybe. But maybe it's hard to grasp, but it's also very, very powerful. It's an important experience. Tsongkhapa, in one of his books, has a really marvelous thing that I didn't see anywhere else. He says that there's three types of mental habit, perceptual habit. And one is a perceptual habit of something as being absolutely there. And there's a second one is a perceptual habit of not seeing anything there. Having that thing that would seem to be absolutely there, having it disappear. You can perceive, you can have an experience like that, seeing through thing. And the third one is perceiving things without sort of noticing whether they're really there or not there. Sort of unqualified as to existent or non-existent. And then this is very interesting. And then he says, the unenlightened person only has the first and the third of those perceptual habits. And the enlightened person has those same two perceptual habits, but adds the second one to it. So it means that that experience of everything being nothing is a very powerful one, but it isn't the true state of affairs. But it's kind of a counter to the experience of everything as being absolutely there. So since we have a habit of thinking that things are intrinsically or absolutely or objectively there, when we really focus deep down on them, we can have a mental experience like we were a cyclotron, you know, like an electron accelerator or something, where it disappears. You definitely can have that experience. And and some people think that's the experience of emptiness, but it isn't. It's an experience of sort of seeming disappearance, seeming annihilation. Actually, people are frightened of it. People recoil from that experience. But somehow, by having had that experience, when one sees the thing again, as if it was really there, but has once had an experience of it disappearing, its real there-ness seems illusory. It has a kind of illusory quality, because you know if you press down on it, it will disappear, sort of thing. You follow me? So somehow then, enlightenment is somehow being able to encompass those two opposite things, which seems impossible to us, of course, because we think it's either this or that. You know? But enlightenment is I call it sometimes the ultimate tolerance of cognitive dissonance. And then, if that seems to you completely impossible, then remember next last time you looked in a mirror. Then when you looked in the mirror, you saw something that had seemed to be really there. There's Bob Thurman in that mirror. Well, his left eye and his right eye have switched places, but otherwise, that's him there. And he's through that window, another guy like me. Like, we have a dog called Miko, and he will bark at himself, his reflection. He never stops. He didn't figure it out. Sometimes bumps into the glass and barks and barks. And he's really sweet, you know. The dumber he is, the sweeter he is. But point is, we know that's an illusion, that there's a three-dimensional person in there when we look in the mirror. Or even if we look in a rearview mirror and see a scene behind us in a car, we know that it's behind us. It's not through a window. We know that. And we don't have to think about it. So we see it as if it were there, and we interact with it when it's somewhere else. So we have that cognitive dissonance is completely encompassed in that one cognition. Because we don't have to repeat the experience of reaching at the mirror and bumping into the surface and realizing it's just a reflection. Because we've had that experience. So it's something like that, this thing about the three perceptual habits of there-ness and not-there-ness and then not qualifying. You know, when you see something in peripheral vision or something, an example of the not qualifying. You know, if I'm looking at you and I kind of am aware of the pillar out there or somewhere, but I don't kind of like get focused on it. It's in my perception, but it's not noticed, and therefore it's not qualified as being really there or not there. That's an example of that. So I'm launching right into, because we're doing Heart Sutra, right? So Heart Sutra just means that if you just remember from the very beginning that emptiness means infinite relativity, is actually what it means. It's the discovery of relativity. It's not the discovery of a kind of deeper nothingness. It's infinite relativity. Then, you know, you will not be frightened if you have an experience of empty, some kind of feeling of everything disappearing. And you will maybe a little bit draw strength from the infinity of the universe, that, you know, anything is possible, you know. And the positive ending, happy ending to history could be the case. You know, best of all possible worlds could be, even in spite of Mr. Voltaire, dear old Voltaire in his garden, best of all possible worlds could be the case. And therefore we could have an ideal opportunity of life here in the kind of human being that we are to fully understand the nature of things. We really could. It's possible. We don't think so. We feel very frustrated with a lot of things we don't know. You know, we're like where we are. But it's possible we could come to be free. And we also think we're resigned to thinking that we're going to suffer and things are going to go wrong. Everybody's like half miserable. And I even, you know, people laugh when I say, but it's true. We're conditioned to think when we do for temporarily don't feel miserable, we feel really worried. So when we feel a little bit happy and we're sort of, yeah, but really I'm miserable, when that feels, this makes us feel secure about being happy. That it's only being reflected in the ongoing stream of our misery. So then we feel safe. We are kind of temporarily jolly, but we kind of don't notice. And we say, no, I'm really miserable, you know. It's not really good enough. Right? You look doubtful, but you smile. I'm talking to my friend there. Okay, I mean, you're all my friends, but that particularly, she knows what I'm talking about. Okay, so that's the Heart Sutra. It's not, emptiness is not nothingness. And even there are people who go saying, I realized emptiness. And in a way you can say that, but in a way if you perceive, if you have an experience of empty space or something, that's not emptiness. Knocking on this tabletop is emptiness, just as much as an experience of empty space. Really. And actually, it's almost, knocking on the table is more challenging experience of emptiness, you know. Emptiness is a straight what they call an exclusion negation, an absolute negation. And so in a way, what emptiness means, how do you understand emptiness? When you're looking at the nature of things, and then you really look deeply and you drill down, as Bill Gates used to like to say when he was running Microsoft, you drill down into a problem, you know, you really focus deeply on looking into the nature of something. And then the thing in that meditative thought experiment, that contemplative thought experiment, you actually don't see the thing anymore. And even you don't see yourself not seeing it or seeing it. And even then you will have an experience as if you will kind of be consciously unconscious. That will be a very deep experience. You'll encounter nothingness. But then your realization of emptiness is you know that the nothingness is nothing. It's the emptiness of nothing. The emptiness of nothingness. So you realize that nothingness is not an object. It's not a place you are. And that is your realization of emptiness. So when you drill through the nothingness and your sense of disappearing disappears, then you're here. And then where you are is a different place because you're in an infinite relativity. So everything is possible. Do you follow? See, it's not difficult, is it? It's not rocket science. It's okay. Actually, I learned something marvelous from a friend yesterday that I had never heard. Just to show you, 50 years, you can always hear something new. And there's a thing about the realization of emptiness or clear light in an oral tradition, in the Tibetan tradition. And it says, one, nothing appears to me. Right? Well, and that has a double possible meaning, right? So nothing appears. So I see nothing. I know emptiness. I experience bliss. I am clear light. It's like 4 points. I really like it. I see nothing. I know emptiness. Because you can't see emptiness, because your seeing is emptiness, of course. I experience bliss. I am clear light. Clear light means clear light of emptiness. It's like clear light is how the mind expands in the sense of an infinite emptiness. I just love that. Don't you love that? But what's great about it is that it doesn't claim that you see emptiness. People who think they see emptiness, actually what they did is saw nothing. They thought that was emptiness. Then they get all crazy, you know. They act like I'm omnipotent, I'm enlightened or something. They get caught in the demon ghost cave, as they say in Zen, of thinking that they're enlightened. But I always like to tease such people. I say, everybody is enlightened then, because everybody sees nothing every night when they fall asleep. And if they have trouble falling asleep, they take an Ambien in order to see nothing. In other words, become unconscious. So when you see nothing, then the knowing of emptiness, what does that mean? Negation is a strange thing. A negative cognition, think about it. A negation means, like, there's no elephant in this room. That's a negation. So then if you want to verify, check that out, you look everywhere where there could be an elephant. And then you don't find one. And then you say, yeah, there's no elephant in this room. But you never find a non-elephant, right? You just keep trying, and then you finally decide that, you know, I've looked enough. There's no closure, in other words. It just keeps opening. The lack of an elephant, it keeps opening up. So similarly, knowing the emptiness after seeing nothing means that the nothing is not an object. It's not a place. I'm not in nothing. There is no nothing. Emptiness negates the nothing, in other words. So the nothing doesn't get in the way of all the somethings. Do you follow me? In a way, the illusory experience of seeing nothing is just the last illusion, in a way. Okay? So gate, gate, paragate. Gate means gone. So that might be equatable to seeing nothing. Again, second gate, but I know emptiness, so I know whatever I see, if I really try to find it, it will disappear. So emptiness is the constant expansion, the opening of negation, of a sense of objectivity of whatever it is, including your immersion in a state of nothingness, seeming state of nothingness, right? So knowing emptiness keeps you, they say emptiness is a medicine for becoming attached to the intrinsic objectivity of whatever you see or personally experience. Then, by constantly opening, what happens? Your sense of boundary and your sense of self-enclosure melts, and we call that bliss, don't we? Like when you have a thrill, if you're a thrill seeker, you get on the Coney Island cyclone, and you get so scared, you have terror when it goes like that. But then if you get past the fear, you have like a thrill, where you sort of dissolve your normal sense of self. You never want to go out like this in some kind of terrible thing. It would be so fearful, you would absolutely recoil from it. Like, I hate them, I get dizzy. You know? But when I was little, I enjoyed them. Or other kinds of aesthetic experiences where you seemingly melt, you lose your sense of boundary, you merge with the raga, you merge with the symphony, you merge with the aria, you merge with some beautiful thing, you know. So that's the experience of bliss, when it's experienced, it's not seized, it's given up. It's where you let go of yourself, you know. And then the thing of I am the clear light is just an affirmation. In a way, it's not that you see clear light, it's that you sort of infer clear light, actually. That's a little more complicated, that's sort of tantric, but that's the Bodhi, that's the last one. Gate, gate, para gate, para samgate, you know, super gone, super totally gone. Those are two further stages of those four, and then the fifth one, Bodhi, enlightenment, all hail. That's like, I am clear light, you know. I am transparency. That's it. That's Buddhahood, you know, right? And every single one of you is going to have that experience. You're going to be a Buddha. Because you might as well. Because there's no other way out of pain, out of the pain, actually, according to them. Because we are all infinite continua. So we want to be the most best continuum. And each of us, and the best continuum is to be a continuum of love and freedom and bliss. Wouldn't you say? It'd be nicer to be blissful forever, wouldn't it, rather than be miserable forever. And if you know you're going to be miserable forever, you're definitely going to do something about it. The reason that we're complacent in our materialist culture is that we think we just get annihilated by dying. Very sad. Recently, someone that we know jumped off a bridge, you know, young woman, wonderful young woman, but the tendency to depression, feeling very bereft and unhappy, jumped off a bridge. I think subliminally, that kind of reckless thing has to do with the idea that that will just annihilate the problems. But the problem there is, if you have a problem and you have a body, you have something, you have a space in which to work on the problem. If you have a problem and you eliminate the body, then all you are is the problem. So that's really not a really very good method of dealing with the problem, unfortunately. Okay. But it's an unimaginable thing. I mean, imagine, suddenly you have a vision of the interconnection of everything in the world. If we had that today, I think that climate deniers might go and eliminate some morons in the Congress who are running around pretending that the military is not allowed to build the docks at Newport News at a 6 foot higher because they're expecting the sea level to rise because the military studies the environment. But now they're not allowed to mention that. They can't do a single thing about preparing for climate. Otherwise, military was saying that it's a major threat to the nation, which their job is to defend the nation, not against people, but against an outraged environment, right? But now they're not allowed to by certain employees. You know the joke. You know it's a really bad recession because ExxonMobil has laid off 200 congressmen.
I'm Gary Gawk, and this poetry segment is a part of the Bob Thurman podcast. I'm reading a poem with an introduction by Al Young, born May 1939. Al is an American poet, novelist, essayist, screenwriter, and professor. In 2005, he was named Poet Laureate of California. He is the author of numerous books, including Conjugal Visits, Drowning in the Sea of Love, a musical memoir, and Heaven, Collected Poems, 1956-1990. He is also editor of African American Literature, A Brief Introduction and Anthology. In 1965, he wrote, "I enjoyed the first of a remarkable and continuing series of non-drug-induced mystical experiences that I consider thus far to be the high points of my life. I no longer feel compelled, as I once did, to speak of these experiences directly. I have learned quite painfully that most people are not especially eager to hear of such things, and many, in fact, feel threatened or frightened by them. For me, the writing of poetry is a spiritual activity. Poetry should be a music of love, song, a dance, the joyously heartbreaking flight of the human spirit through inner and outer space in search of itself." From Natural Process, an Anthology of Black Poetry, 1971, this is The Curative Powers of Silence by Al Young. Suddenly, I touch upon wordlessness. I, who have watched Cheryl, the blind young woman who lives up the street, out walking at night when she thinks no one's looking, deliberately heading into hedges and trees to touch them and seemingly to also be kissed. Thus are we each hugged and kissed, kissed in daylight, licked in a fog. Wordless, I fill up, listening for nothing at all. As when in life, so-called, I am set shivering with warmth by a childlike vision of the Cheryl in me when I think no one's looking, plopped in a field of feathery grass, under watchful trees, letting the pre-mind dream of nothing at all. Nothing at all. No flicker. No shadow. No voice. No cry. Not even dreaming. Being dreamed. For more information about Al, visit his website, alyoung.org. His name is spelled A-L-Y-O-U-N-G. I'm Gary Gawk, and this poetry segment has been a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast and is published by Tibet House U.S., Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal. Tashi Dell.